Hello, and well, I'll switch my camera on. I think this is probably better that way. Okay, hello, welcome back to Millennial 2019, and I'm now here with Jared Taylor of Amren. I think everyone knows who Jared is and what he's done, but Jared, would you like to begin by telling people how they can find you, just for the sake of it, even though I'm sure everyone already knows.
Oh, we can't necessarily make that assumption. Our website, the American Renaissance website, is at amren.com, amren.com. And we have a YouTube channel. We still have a YouTube channel, amazing, hanging on by a thread. And that is at American Renaissance at YouTube. We also have a podcast channel at Amren Podcasts at YouTube, likewise hanging on by a thread. But we're preparing to have those threads cut, but as so many other people are.
Okay, and there is a BitChute channel as well, I believe.
Yes,
I saw it the other day.
that's correct. We have a BitChute channel, American Renaissance. So that's our fallback position, as it is with so many others. And we're considering other alternatives as well. But so far, we're hanging on, and I'm cautiously optimistic. It seems to me if the hammer has not yet fallen, perhaps the hammer will not. But we'll see.
Well, I hope you're correct about that.
Yes.
Okay, so let's speak about your year of 2019. Any thoughts on that?
Oh, 2019, just this last year. Oh, gosh. I think this has been a year of just a fantastic panic over the fact that over the last decade, nationalism has been on the rise all around the white world. The reactions of the people who are dumbfounded and discomfited by the fact that we are attracting so many more people, this urge to censor, this urge to insult, this urge to caricature, all of that is a testimony to how much we've gained. If you look back over the decade, gosh, I mean, we've had some setbacks like the 2015 immigration of all of those people from the Middle East into Europe, but that has created a very healthy reaction. And I would say the latter half of the decade that's gone by has been a very, very encouraging rise of nationalism throughout the European and the European diaspora. Really, in some respects, the only real disappointments are the English-speaking countries: Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States, Britain. I mean, Britain had a flash in the pan back during the 2000s with the BNP, the British National Party, but it sort of petered out after 2014. But we English-speaking people, we are doing well in alternate media. We're putting out loads and loads of wonderful content, I think. We're just lagging in the political era, but we will catch up.
So, why do you think it is that, because that is a point that no one else has made yet on Millennial this year, at least, that the English-speaking countries, the Anglosphere, is behind the continent of the European continent in terms of nationalism.
Yeah, I don't have a really good explanation for that. When people talk about the United States and Britain, generally, and I suppose they're correct, they talk about this first past the post business. So whereas we have a kind of winner take all situation, we don't have in the United States a parliamentary democracy. In most of Europe, you can be on the national stage with 5% of the vote. I think if we had a parliamentary system, if it were possible to get into the United States Congress with 5 or 7% of the vote, we'd be there by now, and we'd be making waves. At the same time, though, certainly in the United States, the major parties, the Democrats and Republicans, really don't have litmus tests. And so anyone can say, I'm a Democrat and run, or I'm a Republican and run. And it's very, very disappointing to me that nicely packaged, articulate, sensible, nice-looking candidates have not come forward in local elections to make all of the sensible arguments that you and I are always making every day. It's a big disappointment to me, and I can't really figure out why. So that is something of a defect, at least in the United States. Now, for the other English-speaking countries, the Canadians, gosh, the Canadians seem to be more whipped and cowed than just about any group I know. It's a very sad situation up to the north. north. As for Britain, you probably know better than I why there have been failures. And after all, as I say, the BNP was around 2008. They were winning council seats. At one point, they had two members of the European Parliament. They had a member on the London Council. It seemed that they were just, in fact, I think at that point, they were probably the most successful nationalist party in the history of Britain. But then it all fell apart around 2014. So, you know, people talk about all of these important national forces that are sort of beyond human control, but an experience like the BNP, I think that shows you just how important contingencies, individuals, accidents are. The people who were involved in the BNP, they succeeded, and then there were problems, there were fallings out, and then there was this terrible decline. And you find the same thing all throughout the European parties as well, the Austrian Freedom Party.
Yes.
Individuals just make a huge, huge difference.
But it does seem to be especially prevalent in the Anglosphere, especially in Britain. But I think that individualism is actually a hindrance to nationalism, to nationalist organizations, because you just end up with ridiculous vendettas, backstabbing, pointless power plays, and so on, which results ultimately in organizations falling apart.
But don't forget, every revolutionary movement, and I don't think it's incorrect to describe ourselves as revolutionaries. I mean, we wish to be the most attractive and unthreatening and most otherwise normal revolutionaries in the history of revolutions. But revolutionaries are always trying to maneuver in a way they're on the margins. And it is groups like that that are, I think, most frequently subject to this sort of vociferous activity. There are people who are out of step in one respect to begin with. So that's more or less to be accepted. You see this in major parties. But in major parties, there is a kind of a structure. There's a situation in which people understand what the rules of engagement are and how to maneuver. It's in the smaller parties that you see that exactly the same thing on the left. So we should not be dismayed by this. This is just a sign of growing pains. But again, I honestly don't have a really satisfying explanation as to why we English speakers are lagging behind our European brethren. And of course, I hope at some point we'll talk about what's happening in Eastern Europe. Those are the mightiest white men on the planet these days. They are way, way, way ahead of us. I envy the government under which the Hungarians live, for example. It'll take us a while to get there, but I'm confident that that's the direction in which we're moving.
I'm convinced that the answer is, that the reason is individualism. But that's my own theory on this. But I might well be wrong, and I'm sure that there are other factors as well. One person did say that the subversion is hardest in the Anglosphere, because that was the most influential part of the West. And so that was the part that had to be most extensively messed up, and our sense of identity most disrupted, and so on. So I think that's maybe true.
I think individualism is a generally European characteristic. And people who study this, Kevin MacDonald, I'm sure you're familiar with him, and many of your viewers are too. He's just written a book on the characteristic of individualism in Western people. And there is a kind of gradient. The further west, the further north you go, the more individualist Europeans are. But we are still, all of us, more European than Middle Easterners, Asiatics, Africans. That is just the way we are. And so we have to work with this as part of our nature. In many respects, I think a kind of individualism, people thinking of themselves, it's a valuable trait. But I 100% agree with you. If we are to succeed, we have to set aside all of our individual egotistic interests. And people have to always think in terms of not what is good for me or my group? What is good for our people? And wherever you have charismatic leaders that rise up, I think, in fact, politics by its nature tends to attract people who are rather self-absorbed, or they have that tendency. And these self-absorbed people put their career, their limelight, their experience, their success before the good of the group that they are ostensibly representing. This is something we have to be on the lookout for. And I think because, as you say, we are so individualist, we have to make sure that we are capable of reining in those people who step forward and claim to be leaders, but who are really working for their own aggrandizement rather than working for the group as a whole.
I could not agree with you more. Another analogy would be not bigger political organizations, but corporations. Often it occurs to me that misbehavior that I see in fringe movements would not be allowed. It would not be tolerated in a corporation where they would have the checks and balances, the procedures and so on to not just root out that kind of behavior, but root out that kind of person who couldn't get along with other people. And
Part of it is that our movement is, for the most part, starving for money. So you depend on people who are volunteers. And it's all very well for people to volunteer. But if you don't have the power of a paycheck, if you're not vetting people, hiring them, giving them jobs with a well-defined list of things that they're supposed to do, it's so much easier for things to fall apart. People have a real seriousness of concentration if this is how they make a living, if they can really work for our movement. And the sad and sorry thing is that we have no real political parties that can support full-time representatives. We have very, very few organizations that can support full-time people. But that is a terrible obstacle. If you're really trying to work on people who are donating their time or donating their resources, you just can't control them in the way that you really have to if you've got a serious organization.
Oh, again, absolutely. This is something that has bothered me for the last 2 years, and especially the last year. If I might speak about my own experience briefly, I was trying to do a lot for the community of content creators and stuff in the first half of this year and the year prior to that, 2018. Because of my own work, my own channel sort of fell by the wayside somewhat. I sort of lost direction with it. So I was concentrating on helping other people. But that meant that I took on so much that it was just overwhelming and incredibly stressful. And I eventually realized if we were on the other side, if we were on the left, we would have so much funding. I mean, compared to what we have, it would be incredible. And we would be able to get done all of these things that we want to get done, all of these ideas that people have and bring to us and so on. So yes. This is something, I'm not moaning about this, I'm just noting the situation. And I hope it is something that is alleviated with time as our movement grows and, as you say, as it professionalizes.
Yes, unquestionably. I suppose my organization, New Century Foundation, which is the nonprofit organization that is the legal entity that runs American Renaissance and all our activities, we actually have 4 full-time people. This is a huge number for our movement. And I suppose some of your viewers are going to think, well, what have you got to show for it? But that just goes to show you how small most of us are. We have really sort of solitary people who become perhaps YouTube stars, but they have maybe somebody working for their part-time, or they have one full-time assistant. We are tiny, tiny, tiny compared to all of the organizations, not just political, but nonprofit, voluntary, that we find arrayed against us, not only on the left, but in the more or less kosher conservative movement. So yes, we need to grow, but I'm very, very encouraged by all the people I see popping up really all around the country, all around the world, who understand the problem perfectly. I must say, one of the things that I've discovered, and this is in attending conferences where you have been in attendance too, in Europe, wherever you go, we all see the same problem. We all suffer from the same suicidal maladies. And to me, not only is it encouraging that there is a kind of common understanding of our common challenges, but the quality of the people that are coming into this movement. I've been in this at this end of the political spectrum for 30 years. And believe me, in the early days, the folks who were involved in trying to understand the world and put the pieces together in a way that makes sense from a white, racially conscious point of view, they were bizarre, misfits, oddballs, but most of, and, you know, considerably odder than myself. But nowadays, I find these really fine, intelligent, attractive, absolutely on the ball young people who, by the time they're 25, they know more than I'd figured out by the age I was 55. Very, very impressive people. And well, this, to me, is a very encouraging sign.
Yes, and the I think that 4chan and the like are very good at resources at accelerating people's development through these ideas. I mean, for me, it took, well, I don't know, 10, 12 years. I can't recall now, from 2002 to 2016. So yeah, 14 years, really.
By today's standards, I'm sorry to say, you're a slowpoke. There are fellows I meet who are just in their mid-20s who've really got a sophisticated understanding of the thing or the way things work. I mean, I didn't figure things out until I was maybe 45. It was a very slow process then. And I would like to think that it's the work of people like you and me, which makes it easier for people to have the scales fall from their eyes. When I first got into this business, you had to write off to obscure P.O. boxes in Olathe, Kansas, or you had to sniff around in dusty corners of university libraries to come up with anything that was remotely dissident. But now, a very sophisticated and a very well-argued system of dissident thought is available just a few clicks away on the internet. The internet really has changed everything. And we really have to hang on to absolutely as much of it as we possibly can. But the consequence is, as I say, much, much better quality of people moving into our end of the political spectrum. And of course, part of it has to do with the fact that the left, as always, is pushing way past any kind of reasonable boundary. They're overplaying their hand. They are insulting ordinary Americans, ordinary Europeans with such callousness and nonchalance that, as I say, the biggest red pill out there is reality.
Well, yes, we saw this with the we saw it 3 years ago with the Brexit election, and we saw it in the referendum. We saw it last week with the general election in Britain, where the left just poured scorn on ordinary people. Yes. And as you say, with complete lack of self-awareness and complete of what it says about their character and how it will affect their chances electorally. They just don't know. They just don't realize that.
I'll give you just an example from last Saturday here in the United States. I don't live far from Washington, D.C., and one of the top old-line elegant hotels is the Willard Hotel. And there was a group of women who are Trump supporters. They had come for a gala weekend in the American capital, and they were just finishing up with a ball in this Willard Hotel. This all women who are Trump supporters. Well, in the ballroom next door, there was a very high-class wedding by a fellow named Smith, who is a fairly prominent Democratic operative. All of these high-class white people getting married to each other and celebrating. Well, they discovered that these women were all Trump supporters, and so they gate-crashed the women who were celebrating. It was a MAGA weekend, and they called them Nazis. They called them, words that I prefer not to use on the air. And they eventually blockaded the place. They assaulted the fellow who was supposed to be the keynote speaker. He was a former SEAL, and he defended himself. But these people were behaving in the most reckless, hateful, contemptuous and contemptible way. They have no idea how odious they appear to ordinary Americans. And this is increasingly typical. And I think it's important to underline that this is something you never see going the other way. You would never find a group of objectors showing up at a meeting of the NAACP or the Democratic Party or some kind of, LGBTQ gathering. You never, never, never find it. It's always these ostensible champions of tolerance and diversity who absolutely can't stand anybody that disagrees with them. And this is becoming so obvious. I think it can't help but shock ordinary, decent Americans out of their complacency.
Yes, let me just first say that, yes, I am eating Maltesers to people who are wondering in the chat, just to keep me going. But yes, it occurred to me last week how amazing it is that the left, if we're going to use those terms just loosely, because I think they do broadly still hold, they seem to consider themselves entitled to disrupt our conferences and our gatherings, our meetings. Yeah. It's like a not just a moral duty for them, but it's something that they are entitled, socially entitled to just do. And it would never occur to us to do the opposite, to just, why don't we just ruin their meeting? Shall we do that? That's unthinkable for our side to do that. And I don't know why. Maybe it's just that they feel they have the permission of the overall culture to do that, whereas we don't feel that.
Well, first of all, they are blinded by a kind of egalitarian rage. They see us not only as wrong, but genuinely evil. I think many of them really do believe that as soon as you start making distinctions of any kind between people, pretty soon you're on a slippery slope and you end up in Auschwitz. They are really convinced of this kind of utter foolishness. So first of all, they're on a moral crusade. At the same time, I remember discovering this with a very considerable interest. Did you realize that the sensation of righteous indignation that stimulates the same parts of the brain that addictive drugs do? And liberals, I believe many of them, are addicted to righteous indignation. They have to experience this. They have to spit fire at their enemies. And that's why, of course, the demand for blatant out-and-out so-called racists far exceeds the supply. And so you have all of these phony racial assaults on poor, unoffending blacks. This gives people just the absolute joy of waving the bloody flag. And they've got an absolute racist in their crosshairs, or so they think. And then there's this tremendous letdown and disappointment when the whole thing turns out to be a hoax. But they have, it's a kind of a modern day equivalent of Puritanism. In many ways, I think you could liken this egalitarian fanaticism to the kinds of cults that used to require deprogramming. You recall these funny cults that people would get stuck up in, and they would devote all their resources to it, and they only would hang out with people who agreed with them 100%, and they had to be sort of kidnapped and deprogrammed. I think of mainstream liberalism as something as akin, as something that is equally difficult to shake out of people as this kind of cultish behavior.
Yes, and I've said for some time, they need to hate us. They need us to be evil. They need to dislike us and sort of disapprove of us and whatever, far more than we need to disapprove of, for example, immigrants.
Right. As if there were any comparison. And, you know, the utter brazenness of people who behaved the way that wedding party behaved against this group of women, for heaven's sake, for them to then have the utter gall to accuse us of being haters. For heaven's sake, they behave in just such hateful ways. It is difficult for me that they do not see the irony between their accusations and their behavior. But you're absolutely right. Not only do they need to hate us, they thrive on it. It's meat and drink for them. They wouldn't know what to do without it. It's this sense of being so superior and on the right side of history, and goodness, truth, and beauty are marching on, and they're carrying the flag in the forefront. It's just an astonishing state of mind, but it is sadly so widespread in the West.
Yeah, I think it's almost religious, and people have made this comparison that without, you know, with the downfall of Christianity, this the belief in equality takes over and becomes this crusade. Yeah. And I think they do see it. I mean, that does bear out. I mean, they do behave as if they're on this righteous moral crusade to rid the world of, you know, people who don't believe in equality.
People like you and me. We are just horrible obstacles to this great Shangri-La in the sky that they're all moving towards. And I think they genuinely believe if people like us can be eliminated, then, you know, the whole world is going to hold hands and sing Kumbaya. yeah, and black people are going to become just like white people, and white people are going to become just like Asians. And it will just all be this undifferentiated wall-to-wall blissfulness. I think at some level they really believe that, or at least certainly they pretend to in a very convincing way.
Yes, indeed. Actually, that reminds me of one of my earlier guests and millennial was saying that it's all about values. And because I know this will be a question that you get asked a lot, but it's just it seems to have come up naturally. So I'll ask you, what would you say to someone who said it's all about values and these people will integrate as long as we just have to try harder to integrate them?
Well,
it's a funny question, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I'd like to know where it's succeeded. Here in the United States, we've been trying to integrate black people since 1619. It's how many years? That's 400 years. 400 years of trying to integrate black people. It hasn't worked very well. Of course, people say, oh, there was slavery, there was this, there was lynching, there was Jim Crow. You know, the United States has poured more moral energy into integration with the black people than I believe anything since the Second World War, or certainly in terms of moral intellectual energy, even more than what went into the Second World War. We haven't tried anything as hard as we've tried that. And look at the results. Race relations are worse than ever. The other thing, of course, is there is the potential of biological disappearance. Biologists are very concerned about, for example, making sure that the Cuban alligator, which is very similar to the Florida alligator, that they don't swim across the 90 miles and get together and mate, because the poor Cuban alligator, of whom there are not very many left, would be swamped genetically. Well, who cares about white people? Apparently, we're supposed to live happily ever after with everybody from everywhere. Well, even just as a matter of aesthetics, I think that it would be a terrible pity if white people went the way of the dodo. I just like the way we look. And at the same time, why would we ever think that people who are not the biological heirs of Western civilization would carry it forward in a meaningful way? We have absolutely no reason to think that. And for us to be dicing with the future of our existence as a distinct people, and we have every right to continue as a distinct people, and also be dicing with the future of what is this glorious civilization that's been passed down to us in the name of some kind of futile egalitarianism. It is a form of mass suicide, the like of which we have never, ever seen in human history.
Oh, yeah, it's incredible.
Yes,
and
yes.
I was just saying earlier to a previous guest, that they were asked a question about the Scottish wildcat, which he actually brought it up himself. Apparently, they think there's something only like under 40 of these purebred Scottish wildcats in Scotland at this point. And of course, there's great worry and concern about this, that they're going to go extinct. And I just couldn't help hearing and thinking the obvious thing. You know, why does it matter if the Scottish wildcat goes extinct, but it doesn't matter if the Scottish go extinct?
That's right.
Come on. It's obvious.
It is a form of insanity in which people understand that if you're talking about the milk yield of cows or the speed of racehorses or the intelligence of border collies for herding sheep, that breeding makes an enormous difference. In fact, it all comes down to breeding. But all of a sudden, if you're talking about human beings, no, it's pure environment. How come it's pure environment only for us? Just these leaps into just chasms of foolishness with ordinary people who, under ordinary circumstances, think logically. All of a sudden, when we think about human biology or racial differences, it's as if people have been taking these really powerful, stupid pills, and they are utterly incapable of drawing conclusions that would be obvious in any other area of investigation. It's very, very hard to understand. I agree. I was actually in a debate a couple of years ago with a black professor, and the subject was, is racial diversity good for America? Well, you can imagine which side I took on that debate. And this fellow, who was a light-skinned black guy, he said, well, at some point in the debate, he says, racial diversity is great, because what that means is in 200 years, there'll be no more white people. And that's a good thing. Good grief. If anyone were to dare say Well, you know, through interbreeding, you know, they're not going to be any more Hopi or Navajo or Cherokee. And that's a great thing. We're just going to eliminate the Eskimos because we're just going to breed them out of existence. People think you're a monster. But here's a guy, he's a professor at Eastern Kentucky State University, and there are absolutely no repercussions for him saying, you know, 200 years, it's going to be 200 years from now, it's going to be great. No more white people. I was just taken aback at the brazenness of it. I suppose there are many who would think that and many who look forward to that. But for him to say that just so nonchalantly as if it was the most natural thing in the world. No, no thanks. We don't want to go extinct.
I remember you being outraged by that at the time and bringing it up, I think maybe in last year's Millennial.
Oh, did I? I'm repeating myself.
No, it's okay. It's interesting how it's had such a, it's something that you clearly remember as a key moment in your debating career. It really stood out as that guy had just said something genocidal.
Yes, and cheerfully so. Well, it seems to have stuck in your mind too, but you know, this reminds me of the way the left scoffs at this idea of the Great Replacement. That's a conspiracy theory. It's not really happening. And anybody who talks about the Great Replacement is obviously an unhinged and just utter ignoramus. But then on the other hand, they are gloating at the prospect of the United States electoral map changing, for example, because of demographic change. If they notice it, and if they like the consequences, then it's okay to notice that white people are dwindling away. But if we notice it and we object, it's not even happening. It's a conspiracy theory. It's an illusion. Just the utter double standard on this. And, you know, I've been asked about this by some, by journalists, and they say, well, you know, what difference does it make? You know, so there are fewer white people. Well, I can give them a perfect example, and one is that I asked them, well, when's the last time that a majority of white people voted for the Democratic presidential candidate? And, of course, they don't know. It was back in 1964. Not since 1964 have a majority of white people voted for the Democratic presidential candidate. But, of course, non-whites vote massively for the Democrats. And that is the only explanation of why we had Jimmy Carter, we had Bill Clinton, and we had Barack Obama. White people didn't vote for these. And so on those three occasions, you could say white people didn't get the president that they wanted. Why? Because of the Great Replacement. It used to be, back when the country was 90% white, if you won the white majority, you became president. Now, that's just not enough. You can win 45% of the white vote. I'm sorry. You can win 55% of the white vote, as some of the unsuccessful Republicans did, and still not become elected. That's just one interesting sort of political example of what happens when the demographics change. But all sorts of other things happen culturally. Politically, the texture of life, everything changes. And for them to pretend that this is somehow not happening, or if you really hold their feet to the fire, they say, oh, but it's a good thing. It's a good thing. The fewer whites, the better, apparently. The other people come marching in from all around the world. The United States is up for grabs. The UK is up for grabs, you know, and whoever grabs it, it'll be much, much, much better for the grabbing. It's so astonishingly insulting to the people who built these countries. We're supposed to, I suppose, you know, the idea is diversity. Diversity is our wonderful strength. Are we supposed to walk up to these Mexicans and Haitians and Guatemalans and Vietnamese and thank them for saving us from choking to death on our own fatal homogeneity? They're the people who've made this a great country. It's just sick. And it's, as I say, so preposterously insulting.
Oh, absolutely. I wonder sometimes if the reason... The reason that that guy, the black guy, could get away with saying what he said, and obviously the converse would never be tolerated, do you think it's because liberals, deep down, they don't really believe that this is white extinction is ever actually going to happen? Like, we're never actually going to be outnumbered. It's never actually going to change that much. It's all going to be fine, really. It'll keep continuing just as I've always known it in my own life. Do you think that's what's really going on in their heads?
I wonder. I just don't know. I honestly don't know. These days, I have very few conversations with liberals. I seek them out. I really do want to know whether they genuinely think that as the United States becomes Afro-Hispanic Caribbean, is it really going to be the United States? What do they really want? What kind of world do they want for their children and grandchildren? I would love to know. And I think at some level, they may have certain fears about it, but they dare not admit them. What I always point out to them is when they talk about, you know, oh, it's going to be great, white people are going to be a minority, I ask them, well, can you name even one majority non-white neighborhood you'd like to live in? It's very hard for white people to come up with that. And yet they don't dare lift a finger against this process that is going to turn the country more and more and more and more into neighborhoods they'd never live in. Or if you ask them, can you think of a majority non-white school you'd like to send their children to? Even the most liberal of liberals, you know, they'll gulp at that one. So,
funnily enough, I asked that to one of my previous guests, and he said no, he wouldn't send his kids to them. And yeah, you're quite right.
But you know, you may be right. It may be a failure of imagination on their part. Their imagination is utterly and completely stunted by the joy they have, the joy they feel in this kind of righteous indignation and the sense that they are rooting out the worst possible sort of evil. And I honestly don't know. There are people who suspect that deep down, white liberals are a kind of white supremacist in that they feel that ultimately they're going to call the shots. Even as their numbers decline, they'll be the ones who will be ultimately telling the black people and the Hispanics and the Asians what to do. I just don't know. It's increasingly difficult for me to inhabit the mind of a liberal and to try to understand what it is they genuinely think about this nation that they appear to be trying so hard to build.
Yes. I think there is disbelief in a lack of, as you said, failure of imagination. Another thought that perhaps calms them down about this prospect is they think, well, when other races take over, they'll just be like me. They'll be champion socialists like me. And so nothing will actually change very much. So that's when they're more concerned about the cultural angle. Everyone will still be drinking pumpkin spice lattes. That in their head, they're so naive about the future that they think the culture will remain the same. But of course, this ignores the fact that I think they also are racially concerned. They just haven't, they're just in total denial about that fact.
Well, it's certainly true. When the neighborhood goes the wrong way, they clear out, don't they? Even the most liberal ones. And as I've said to many journalists, as a matter of fact, the vast majority of white people agree with me. Just look at what they do, not what they say. And yet, how can they do those things and then yet say the things that they continue to say? It's very mysterious to me, and I really wish I did have more opportunities to explore the minds of liberals in a genuinely inquiring way. But it is they who refuse to have conversations of this kind. If you start asking, even in the politest sort of way, just in what world would they be a conservative? What's the world they want to live in? What do they see as the future of the United States or of Europe when it becomes decreasingly white? Why is that going to be a good thing? How is it going to be a good thing? They refuse to talk in concrete terms. In many cases, they just refuse to talk about it at all. Even bringing up the question of this kind is deeply offensive to them, which does suggest that, you know, as you were hinting earlier, they just haven't thought things through. They think it's somehow all going to be the same anyway, despite the fact that it very, very obviously is not. I remember the great Guillaume Fay. He called this kind of egalitarian mania AIDS of the mind, that this kind of virus infects them to the point where somehow all the normal immune responses disappear, and then all of these invading microbes come pouring in, and eventually the host is killed. I don't have a good explanation for it.
I think one thing that is not a root cause of this, but is a surface or just under the surface symptom of it, is a lack of seriousness, a chronic lack of serious thinking. which enables them to just believe whatever they like. As you say, they don't think things through. And I see this a lot.
Yes, yes. And that's why when you ask them, you know, quite specifically, well, how is it going to work out? I mean, one question I like to ask liberals is, you know, there are about 13,000 school districts in the United States, 13,000. And in every one of them, we see this consistent pattern of racial differences in school performance. Asians at the top, and then whites a little bit below, and then considerably below that, Hispanics, and then somewhat below that, blacks. We have the same pattern, 13,000 different school districts. Is this because in every single one of them, there is this sort of structure of racism and white privilege and institutional inequality that somehow arranges for this pattern to repeat itself time after time after time, year after year after year, despite all of these initiatives and efforts to eliminate these gaps? Is that really what's going on? Or isn't the most obvious explanation the true one, that people are just different, groups are different, they're not equivalent, they're not interchangeable, that they just don't have a good answer for this? Well, and because there is no good answer for this, and yet even if you bring this up and you back them into a corner and they admit there's no good answer for this, well, then they just jump over you. They just jump out of the problem, and they refuse to think about it anymore. It doesn't seem to change their way of thinking about anything.
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the things is that they will endlessly come up with reasons why, well, okay, 13,000 school districts, but they're all subject to the same overarching culture. Which right. is white supremacists. But then an obvious question there is, well, why, if these 13,000 districts, hasn't one of them found a way to counteract this
exactly.
national culture?
Not one of them has figured it out. Not one. And despite, and the fact is, you know, you get these academic, these huge, high-powered meetings of all these people from all around the country, how to eliminate the gaps. That is national project number one. That is educational objection number one, how to get rid of the gaps. And, you know, they've been working on this for decades, and they just can't figure it out. That's right. That's why I make the point about the 13,000, and not one of them. Not one of them has figured out how to eliminate this. And the other question I ask is, look, how come Hispanics, a lot of them are brand new in the country, you know, a lot of them don't speak English all that well, but consistently, wherever you go, they slightly outperform blacks. Blacks have been here all this time. Isn't that odd? Isn't that a little peculiar? Wouldn't expect at least some place, you know, the blacks to do better than the Hispanics. And how about the Asians in this white supremacist culture? You know, white people are always hauling themselves up and stepping on everybody's heads. How come Asians, wherever you go, they do better? They're immigrants. You know, we had the relocation camps during the Second World War. We're bad, 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 bad. And yet, somehow they do better than these wicked white supremacists. Explain that. No, it's a reality that they are aware of in some dim way, but they are utterly incapable of grasping the concrete implications of the phenomena that they see.
Another thing that I found quite useful recently in, you know, when I get onto debates on various social media websites, one of them that I find very useful is to simply make them do the work. As often as possible, I make them do the work. And it doesn't always succeed. I can sometimes get indignant. But anyway, I try to make them do the work. And I say to them, why do you believe that different human groups who have evolved separately for many millennia, why do you believe that they would be the same?
Right.
They have no answer to this other than basically, they should be the same. And I thought, but why? It would be miraculous. Not only would it be strange if would it not be strange for them to be different? It would be miraculous for them to be the same.
You know, there's an excellent book called The 10,000 Year Explosion by Henry Harpending and Gregory Cochran. And it's a very straightforward book. They say that after all these years of separate evolution, the idea that every single race would end up with the same stuff between the ears, the chances of that are like taking a fistful of silver dollars and throwing them out and having them all land on their edges. In other words, impossible. That's what real scientists understand. Yes, it's absolutely obvious. But, you know, when I've made that point, you know, I ask people, why would you even think that black people are as smart as East Asians? Why would you even think that? What's the evidence for this? Why would anyone think this? You know, what I always get is anecdotes about, well, look how smart Condoleezza Rice is. I mean, some of your viewers probably don't remember who Condoleezza Rice is. She's a foreign policy advisor for George Bush, Bush the Younger. Look how smart Colin Powell is.
And Thomas Sowell, of course. Everyone knows who he is. We hear his name constantly as the example of black genius.
But good grief. And I say to them, look. I mean, that's just so stupid. I can show you a woman who is taller than most men. But does that refute the rather obvious observation that men as a whole are taller than most women on average? It doesn't change the fact. Yes, you have these oddball outliers in all races, but no, that is the only response I've ever had, is someone will trot out some allegedly super high IQ black person to prove that the average black is just as smart as the average white.
Indeed. And it's preposterous. For the time being, we have to put up with these silly arguments.
Yes. At least, you know, in a way, though, whenever I debate one of these liberals, and I don't get as many opportunities as I'd like, I think it's rather fun to talk to them. I feel sorry for them in a way, because I've thought about these things and they haven't. They think in terms of slogans. Diversity is our strength, diversity makes us stronger. They think that some of them have just such preposterous historical notions. The slogan of the motto of the United States is E Pluribus Unum, which is Latin for out of many one. And a lot of them actually think that means out of many people, many races and languages, we have one country. Doesn't mean that at all. They're flabbergasted when you point out that, no, it means out of 13 individual colonies and states, we got one federal government. They don't even know that. They're just such ignoramuses when it comes to any kind of racially relevant American history. They don't know anything about the science of IQ differences. And so they're just baffled. They're baffled and furious when they run into somebody who actually knows something about this. I remember years ago, some newspaper reporter, he was from Louisville, Kentucky, he complained that I was overeducated. What an admission of ignorance to accuse your debate partner of being your antagonist as being overeducated. Well, you know, that's an insult that I can take.
Indeed. I think since we're approaching the 13 minutes left, so we'll move on straight to the super chats. If anyone has super chats, please post them right now, because we're going to have to rattle through these. So, okay. And I just let me quickly say, I know you haven't been doing many debates recently, but I have really enjoyed the ones that I think each one is a pleasure to listen to. I have to say that. I'm not just, you know, groveling. I really do enjoy listening to them, because there's, and I'm glad that they're, you know, like each one is recorded and then it can go up, and it's a fun, entertaining, interesting example of how to handle these questions in a debate. It's really good.
Well, you're very kind to say so. Of course, every time afterwards, I think of some utterly devastating answer that I could have made or should have made and failed to do. But even after years of practice, I still miss the ball a lot of the time. But these days, I won't grant an interview unless we agree that we're going to record the whole thing start to finish. And so that's the only real purpose in doing it. If, you know, National Public Radio or CNN records me for half an hour, they'll just snip up a few little bits. And even if there is a New York Times or whatever it is, talks about me and takes, you know, five words that I said, it doesn't do us one bit of good. We don't get any more traffic. We don't get any more attention. But what we get is a half an hour or 45 minute recording that we can release to the entire world. And a lot of people find those things interesting. And so that's the reason I give interviews. And if I can't record the thing, no, sorry, forget it.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly the right attitude to have with these things. If it's not going to be content for us, then no.
That's right.
Because they'll just misuse it.
Yes. Okay. And you know, I had a terrible... Oh, are we running out of... I should let you proceed if we're running out of time.
Okay. All right. Have you planned any more debates in the near future? You are always calm and reasonable, a great advocate for every European.
You know, I don't have any scheduled, but I'm always receptive to anybody who comes my way. Just recently, I had a very weird debate with a Muslim. A Muslim contacted me, and he wanted to talk about why Islamic immigration is good for America and the West. I was very surprised that he wanted to do this. He says he's going to record this and going to put it up on his channel. I said, okay. Well, we talked for, I guess, a little over an hour. What he ended up putting up on his channel, he had carved about 20 minutes out of it. And I said, hey, what gives? He said, well, there were things you said that, you know, you just didn't want to publicize. So I put a little comment on his channel to see the real thing come to the AMRAN channel. Funny. But no, he invited me. I thought, in my own modest way, I think I just crushed him beneath the wheels of my chariot. But it was his invitation, and that's what he decided to do. But that was sort of came right out of nowhere. It wasn't a media guy. Here's a guy who is a professed Muslim missionary to America. He wants everyone in the world to be Muslim.
Is this the man who kept saying, I'm just trying to understand?
No, that's Fareed Zakaria. See, what I should have said to him, and I only thought of this later, is, no, Brother Fareed, you're trying very hard not to understand, and you're doing a great job. But I didn't think of that at the time. This happens to me always.
All right. Okay, here's another question. During colonial times, the Spanish and the Portuguese treated their subjects worse than Britain and France did, but yet they didn't prevent miscegenation. Why is this?
Well, the problem was they just sent mostly men over, the Spaniards and the Portuguese, and men will do what men do. And that's why you got all this miscegenation. In the English-speaking colonies, and to a large extent the French as well, they came over as families. And so they had a very vivid sense of us versus them. So there wasn't nearly as much miscegenation. I think that's the explanation. If you send men anywhere and there are women, there's going to be miscegenation.
Yes, I think so. Do you see any similarities between Australian and Canadian colonial history?
Well, to the extent that they were colonized by the British, the fact that Britain was a penal—I'm sorry—that Australia was a penal colony—that's a weird way to start off. And you know, they became a penal colony because the North American colonies had been a dumping ground for all the convicts and the paupers and everybody else, all the refuse that the British wanted to get rid of. But parallels of that kind, you know, I'd have to think about that. I remember reading Australian history and being fascinated to realize that all of the different states Queensland and I can't remember now, the various parts.
New South Wales,
yes. All of these were originally separate independent colonies. And it was a rather uneasy process whereby they became one united country. But there's a certain similarity between that and, of course, the fact that Canada is this uneasy coalition between English-speaking and French-speaking. But no, I'm not an expert on that by any means, so I should probably not have said one word. I should have said, I don't know enough to give you an answer.
Okay. Mr. Taylor, thank you for all that you do. If hate speech laws are ever passed in America, do you think they will be applied? Well, first of all, do you think hate speech laws will ever be passed in America? And if they are, do you think they will be applied where hate speech is directed towards whites?
I think hate speech laws are conceivable in the United States, but I don't think they will happen for quite some time. I think we would have to have Democratic presidents who appointed nothing but Democratic judges for maybe several decades, maybe 50 years before the First Amendment really is gutted in a meaningful way. That really is a strong tradition in the United States. Freedom of speech, the government cannot muzzle me no matter how much The people who run the show hate what I say. They cannot shut me up. Now, private companies, they will say they can do that. Twitter can pick you, can kick you off. YouTube can shut down your channel. That's all very well and good. But to make it, in fact, illegal for me to say the things that I say, I just don't see that really in my lifetime. The United States has a very, very strong tradition of that. And the people who make it to the Supreme Court, and they're ultimately the ones who are going to decide, many of them are steeped in a kind of a traditional respect for the Constitution, believe it or not. Even people like Elena Kagan, people like Sonia Sotomayor, they will read the Constitution in a way that I think for the most part prevents them from saying, okay, Jared Taylor's got to go to jail for what he's been saying. I mean, for heaven's sake, if I got to go to jail, then that means you'd have to send Abraham Lincoln to jail. You'd have to send Thomas Jefferson to jail. You'd have to send Teddy Roosevelt to jail. All these people. All I'm saying is what Americans have been saying for decades, for centuries, frankly. No, I don't think it would happen. But if there are hate speech laws passed in the United States, the answer is no, they won't be enforced equally against those who hate whites or speak in a hateful way about whites. And of course, the whole idea of hate speech, the idea that what you and I are saying is hate speech, is just nonsense. Neither of us have expressed the slightest animus towards anyone in anything that we've said. And to call it hate speech, by the way, that's a rhetorical sleight of hand of absolute genius on the part of our opponents to characterize us as haters, but there's no hate in it at all.
Yeah, I agree. Moving on to the next. Okay. Can we call you Groypersan? Is that a moniker you would appreciate?
Groypersan? No, not really. I'm not keen on neologisms anyway, and Groyper does not strike me as a particularly felicitous name. I know that people use it for what for useful purposes, but I think if we're going to come up with names for ourselves, surely we can do better than Groyper.
Okay. I never really understood where that name came from. Okay, can you list five of your favorite books?
Five of my favorite books? Well, you know, in my own secret life, I'm a great admirer of fiction and even poetry. And this is probably not what the questioner is expecting, but I just reread Paradise Lost. And it is a marvelous achievement of mankind. I just thoroughly enjoyed it. I'd read sections of it in high school. And even in high school, I thought, wow, this is pretty good stuff. This Milton was quite a lad. And I read the whole thing through, and I just loved it. I've been rereading Shakespeare, too. But for lighter fare, I think you can't beat Anthony Trollope. And if anyone wants to just give himself up to the voluptuous experience of 19th century England, he can not do better than read the Barchester Chronicles. So, as again, this may not be what the questioner expected, but all of these things, these are expressions of our culture, and they mean something, I think, to white people that they cannot mean for anyone else. I've written an essay, actually, on literature and white people. Somebody like Dickens or Anthony Trollope, I think it would be the most unusual non-white person who would read those novelists with the same sense of kinship and deep appreciation that a European would.
Okay. Do you think it will be possible to make a deal with the left in which the scourge of white nationalism, as they see it, will be solved by them giving us land in America?
Let's put it this way. I hope so. I think that ultimately, unless things change in ways that are very difficult to imagine, if we are to salvage some bits of Western civilization, we will be able to do it only if we have some portion of the United States that is unmistakably ours and permanently ours. That seems like very much a pipe dream at the present time, but we really have to think in those terms. And increasingly, the way non-whites, blacks in particular, talk about white people. They talk about us in the most contemptuous terms, and they also talk about us as utterly incorrigible. Well, what I would like to do is hold them at their word. I'd like to say to them, okay, we're incorrigible. We can't be changed. We can't be improved. Well, then let us go our own way. We have been living together for 400 years. It's been a bad marriage, a very bad marriage. So let's have a divorce. You go here and we stay there. And this is the only possible solution. Now, of course, when you propose that to blacks, they suddenly get all very nervous because I think deep down they realize that they, you know, they'd end up with Haiti or they'd end up with Togo if they were off on their own. At some level, they realize it ain't going to be Wakanda, fellas. But this is, I think, the only logical solution to these utterly, utterly contemptuous ways that liberals and non-whites increasingly talk about us. We are just incorrigible racists. We are horrible people, okay? If we're that bad, just send us on our way. Let's have some sort of equitable division. Now, so far, that idea doesn't have much place in any kind of public debate. But I think increasingly, those are the terms on which we're going to have to work out some sort of deal.
All right. Okay. Okay.
Am I being too long-winded? Do you have more questions?
No. There are two more. Four more questions.
Uh-huh.
How did it feel back in the 80s or 90s when you and a few others were basically the only people who saw the reasons for different outcomes between the races? Was it lonely?
It was awful. It was terrible. I'd say for the first 20 years of American Renaissance, I just felt as though I was making some kind of record so that when some future Chinaman was putting together the great Chinese world history encyclopedia, he might come across the fact that not every one of these white people was a fool or a coward or an idiot. Yeah. But things are different now. Things are really different. And they've changed, I'd say, in the last 5, 6, 7 years. It's not just making a record. I think there's real chance it's going to be a long fight, but things are completely different now. And this is what I tell the young fellows who have only awakened, say, within the last, say, 4 or 5 years. We have setbacks. We have unexpected failures. In the long term, we are on a steep rise, just going up like mad. And yes, we are vastly, vastly different from the situation of even just 5, 6, 7 years ago, much less 20 years ago. Oh, it was lonely. It was awful. No, this is paradise.
That's good to know. I mean, I definitely think I won't go into my own perspective on this, but just to say that I understand and agree with what you're saying. What effect do you think the next Democratic presidency will have? I have a feeling they'll want to take revenge for Trump and will push internet censorship and far-left ideas much more zealously.
They might. That's certainly possible. At the same time, though, it is possible that a Democratic president might get to the bottom of this terrible, ridiculous border crisis we have. It's all very easy for Democrats in presidential opposition to say, we're just going to abolish ICE. But if it really falls on them to deal with the hundreds of thousands of Central Americans swarming into the country, going on welfare, they might do something about it. They might remember it was Barack Obama who was first separating families at the border and keeping children in one place and adults in another place. When you actually have the responsibility of trying to maintain a government and trying to keep fiscal responsibility when the welfare rolls are ballooning and when the economy goes south, as it eventually certainly will, they may end up being more responsible. Now, as far as internet censorship is concerned, I'm not really all that concerned about who the presidential administration is. The people who run the internet, the big companies, they are going to censor or not. I think, no matter who is president. And it's entirely possible that if we get Elizabeth Warren in the White House, then the big internet people say, hey, we don't need to worry about these clowns as much as we used to. They may dial back on internet censorship. I think, again, that is something that is independent of presidential politics. It's not independent of media pressure. If you get all of these hand-wringing articles about this wicked Jared Taylor and this wicked millennial woes character having access to thousands and hundreds of thousands of people, and oh, it's bad, 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 that, I think, has more of an impact on the decision-makers there than who's in the White House.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, in a sense, it's the cliche that the president doesn't actually have much power. It's what's going on around him, those people.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Another two super chats have come in. Please ask Japanese American gentleman Jared Taylor Jared Taylor San his opinion of the works of Yukio Mishima.
Oh, Mishima was a very, very talented novelist. I don't think he ever won the Nobel Prize for Literature, but I think he deserved it. I have read several of his novels, and he's still widely respected in Japan as a novelist. And of course, he came to a very sticky but spectacular and dramatic end. I don't know whether your viewers are interested in his suicide, but he was very much a Japanese nationalist. He thought that, you know, that Japan had become weak and flabby and was kissing the feet of the Americans. And he went to the equivalent of the Pentagon in Japan, and he kidnapped the equivalent of, he had this group of men that were working with him. They're carrying Japanese swords, and they barricaded themselves in the office of the equivalent of the defense minister. And he ordered the guy to get all these military troops together, and he harangued them from the balcony and gave them this talk about how Japan must rise up and become nationalist again. And they said, I get lost. And so he committed ritual suicide as an expression of his contempt for modern Japan. Very, very dramatic way to go. He was a bodybuilder. He was a homosexual. He made a couple of movies. A very, very remarkable man.
And wasn't he a novelist as well?
I beg your pardon?
Wasn't he a novelist as well?
Yes, as I say, his novels are absolutely beautiful. And he didn't win the Nobel Prize. I think that year it was...
Oh, sorry.
It was Kawabata who won the Nobel Prize when he was most likely to have been... I don't think he did. But no, he's a wonderful novelist. His novels are still translated into English. Sound of Waves is a beautiful one. The Temple of the Golden Pavilion is another one. He wrote a massive trilogy later on in life called The Sea of Fertility, which I never read, but many people think that's a real achievement. Yes, a marvelous, marvelous novelist.
Right, okay. Do you feel the white race should aspire to retake Constantinople?
I think we need to just be left alone. That has been my argument forever. This stuff about, you know, we're a race that must conquer or die. No. I've been trying to stay away from that for a long time. We just want to be left alone. We're satisfied with what we've got. And no. The answer to that question is no.
Okay. Commercialism and spending was the new religion and what helped to destroy any sense of spirituality. It's not a question, it's a statement, but what do you think of it?
What has destroyed spirituality? If that question is, why is the Christian church in decline? I think it probably has to do with widespread scientific understanding. It probably has to do with greater wealth, materialism. When people are not working 12 hours a day just to put food on the table, they've got more time to question dogmas. Materialism is not necessarily, rising standards of living are not necessarily going to result in loss of traditional faith. But I think very frequently they do go hand in hand.
Right. Okay. There is one more question, but I don't think it's... You have shared your boyhood memory of rooting for Ingemar Johansson when he fought Afro-American Floyd Patterson. Will you support will you support Tyson Fury in his rematch with Deontay Wilder?
Good grief. I don't know who they are. I beg your pardon. I'm not much of a sports fan. But I root for the white guy. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Now, one final question, which I've been leaving to the end. Is anything happening with your lawsuit against Twitter?
It's pretty much petered out, I'm sorry to say. But the fellow who was doing the arguing for us, he's got a different client named Megan Murphy, who is a much more attractive plaintiff. And she's much more attractive in that she's a feminist. And she was kicked off Twitter for refusing to refer to a trans woman, that is an ex-man or a former man, or in her view, a current man, as a she. And that was enough to get her kicked off. So we've changed horses on the assumption that a feminist is more likely to get equal justice in the United States than a so-called hater and white supremacist. But Twitter is still being battled, but I'm not the sword with which Twitter is going to be smitten this time.
Right. I didn't know that she'd been banned from Twitter. That's news to me.
Do you know about her?
I've heard of her, but I didn't know that this was a big thing.
Oh, yes. I mean, the case is on appeal now. I think they've got very strong grounds to make sure that Twitter behaves itself. But we'll see. That's the trouble with this notion that these are private companies and they can't be regulated like utilities, although as a practical matter, some of these huge companies really are utilities. But...
Okay.
All right. Well, so have we exhausted the curiosity of your viewers?
Yes, we have.
Very good.
So, and we've been going for an hour and 10 minutes, so that's rather over the time that we agreed. So thank you very much, Jared Taylor. Any final thoughts for people going in as we leave this decade and go into the 2020s?
I have a final thought. I wish you all a white Christmas.
Well, I'm sure that we all wish you the very same, Jared. So thank you for taking part in Millennial 2019. And I hope that we see you again next year.
It's my great pleasure. Thanks for everything you do. It's been a real joy to be on your program.
Thank you very much. To everyone else, that's it for tonight. I'll be back tomorrow night with a set of guests. I can't remember which ones they are just now. Survive the Jive, Critical Condition, Artemisian Aesthetic, and then Philosophy Cat. So that will be tomorrow night. In the meantime, thank you for staying with me through tonight, and thank you, Jared, for appearing, and good night, everyone.